Remember your trolley. Welcome to It Just So Happened. Hooray! I forgot that bit. I am Richard Pulsford, stand-up comedian and rather unprofessional historian. In this show, recorded for the It Just So Happened podcast, we will explore some of the historical people associated with and events which happened on this very day in history, which is the 15th of July. That's before we delve into some of the history of the place where today's show is taking place. So where are we? As a clue for eager listeners, we've already been here three times before, if you count our shows in 2019 and 2021, and our online show in 2020. Yes, it's Buxton! At approximately 1,000 feet above sea level, this town can lay claim to being the highest market town in England and has been made famous by its spring water. So we're performing today as part of the 2023 Buxton Fringe Festival with its striking orange livery, whereas our venue today is the Green Man Gallery. So to those of a Christian religious sensitivity, we're doing our best to appeal to both Protestants and Catholics. And all in the middle of the marching season. So without further ado, let's march on and meet the panel for tonight's show. Please welcome Scott Alsop and Donna Scott. Alsop is a history teacher and history podcaster who runs a popular YouTube channel called History Pod, which focuses on short On This Day in History episodes. So a perfect guest for this show. Is there anything you'd like to tell us about your podcast very briefly?
It's one of those podcasts that started, I think, very much as with yours, Richard, as a bit of a passion project. Love to find out the weird and the wonderful stories of history. Share it with people. I think story in history is the most important bit. And so hopefully you'll get a little bit of that out of what we're doing tonight.
Brilliant, thank you. And Donna Scott is a comedian, writer and performance poet. Donna was the first official Bard of Northampton. She's also... Oh, yeah. I think it deserves that. She's also a cast member of the multi-award-winning children's comedy show The Extraordinary Time-Travelling Adventures of Baron Munchausen and half of sketch duo Prison Biscuits, which reached the quarterfinals of Sketch Off this year. As well as all of that, she was a top 10 finalist of BBC New Voices and reached the finals of Old Comedian of the Year. And you have a show later tonight at Buxton Fringe. Do you want to quickly tell us about that?
Yes, so I've got a show tonight at Bailey's Bar and Restaurant, and it's called Badger. Badger is all about me and my nickname. So I wouldn't call me Badger, but if you might hear people call me Badger, and it's about how I got that nickname and why I think I deserve it. So there we go.
Thank you. So yes, we are one panellist down today, due to circumstances beyond our control. In other words, we couldn't find anyone else. But now it's straight over to you, Scott, for your On This Day piece in history. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, St. Swithin's Day, if thou dost thrain, for 40 days it will remain.
Oh dear.
St. Swithin's Day, if thou be fair, for 40 days will reign no mare. Well, today it's July the 15th. It is, ladies and gentlemen, St. Swithin's Day. And according to that old rhyme that can be traced back to the Elizabethan period, if it rains today, then it will rain for the next 40 days. But fortunately for us, Met Office records prove that the Elizabethans were wrong. Which is rather reassuring, because for those of us in the room know that today Buxton has experienced rain and hailstorms of what can only be described as biblical proportions. full-on rain, hail, lightning, the works. Fortunately, though, there's actually no modern scientific proof that a wet 15th of July, or that the intervention of a long-dead Anglo-Saxon bishop, will actually condemn us to a miserable summer. According to the Guinness Book of Records, the most extreme anti-Swithin legend weather happened in 1924, when a Met Office weather station recorded 13 and a half hours of sunshine on the 15th of July, which was followed by 30 of the next 40 days actually raining. A decade before that, a 15-hour rainstorm on the 15th of July was followed by 30 dry days out of 40. So in the modern age, at least, the legend of St. Swithin's Day rain doesn't really hold any water. That's modern records, though. And to be fair, this is a history podcast. So perhaps we should look at the Elizabethan period instead, since that's the origin of the traditional St. Swithin's Day rhyme. Well, the 16th century was caught in what modern meteorologists refer to as a little ice age. Contemporary records and other physical evidence, such as dendrochronology, that's using tree rings to identify historic events, show that English summer days in the Elizabethan period were actually frequently short and wet. So it's highly likely that it would be raining throughout the summer anyway. To be honest, though, I think that just makes William Shakespeare comparing thee to a summer's day incredibly disappointing. You know, you're going to say, you are more lovely and temperate than a summer's day, and they were provably short and wet. It's hardly the greatest chat of mine, really, is it? But I digress. The 15th of July is the feast day for St. Swithin, as it marks the day in 971 that St. Swithin's body was removed from its original simple grave outside the west door of the Old Minster in Winchester and reburied in an elaborate shrine inside the newly built cathedral that was dedicated to him instead of the saints Peter and Paul. This actually went against Swithin's own deathbed request that he should be buried outside, where both members of the parish and, quote, the blessed rains from the heavens could easily reach his grave. And if the stories are to be believed, then he was not best pleased at his body being moved, since the ceremonial exhumation was followed by 40 days of thoroughly miserable weather. It's interesting, though, that Swithin was actually given such a significant later burial, since barely any records exist of him during his life. The only significant mention comes with his death, while he was serving as the Bishop of Winchester, that's recorded in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle as happening in 861. It therefore wasn't until over a century later that interest in the rainy day saint resurfaced, and he was thrust into the spotlight again, courtesy of a couple of Benedictine monks who'd come over to England from Flanders and wrote a load of accounts of his life that were probably a bit liberal with the truth. Nevertheless, it's in those accounts that we find the incredible miracle of the egg woman, in which, I know, it's very exciting, in which St. Swithin repaired a lady's basket of broken eggs. I know. It is, however, unclear from the various accounts whether this is because she dropped the basket at the shock of having seen the ghost of Swithin on a bridge, or whether a group of workmen had just smashed them. That's in one of the accounts. He was later associated with another miracle. Now, this regards Queen Emma, the mother of Edward the Confessor, who was proven to be innocent of adultery with Elfwin, the former Bishop of Winchester, after she emerged unscathed from a very medieval trial by ordeal in which she was forced to walk across hot blades in Winchester Cathedral. It's therefore attributed to St. Swithin that he intervened to ensure that the Queen was unscathed. It's also within those accounts from the Benedictine monks that we learn much about Swithin's association with royalty. The 9th century King of Wessex, that's King Egbert, is said to have sought Swithin's counsel and then later employed him to tutor his son, Elfwulf, who in turn got him to tutor his son, Alfred, as in the Great. Now, certainly the chronology fits. And so, as the only English ruler to have ever been given the cognomen the Great, we should probably tip our collective hats to St. Swithin as Alfred's teacher. Although, if the story of the cakes is to be believed, then he was presumably not so good at teaching food technology or home economics. Tipping his hat, though, could prove to be a challenge for poor old St. Swithin. Thanks to the medieval fascination with holy relics, sometime after his reburial in the Winchester Shrine, his head was removed from his body and taken to Canterbury Cathedral, while Peterborough Cathedral took one of his arms. I know. He couldn't fight back there. But sadly, then, his original shrine, including the wonderfully named Holy Hole, which allowed pilgrims to crawl from outside Winchester Cathedral right underneath St. Swithin's burial place, was destroyed in the Reformation. But nowadays, a modern representation of St. Swithin's tomb occupies that place in Winchester where the original one once stood. So, for the tomb, much like the legend surrounding the weather, I guess you could say there isn't really much in it. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Scott. Apparently, the weather station on the slopes in Buxton, just that way, isn't it? That has unbroken records going back as far as 1865, which makes it the third oldest weather site in the United Kingdom. Weather stations, yeah. For the first 60 years of its existence, it was based in the grounds of the Royal Devonshire Hospital. Now, it's hard to imagine now, but the highest ever temperature recorded in Buxton was 35.9 degrees, reached at 2:24 p.m. on the 19th of July last year. I think this is how averages work. Anyway, so I'm going to do an On This Day piece as a segue between the panellists. So this is a question for the panel. Who was Tom Thumb?
Oh, so this is the nursery rhyme.
Yes.
So he had a pie and he stuck in his thumb and he pulled out a plum and said, what a good boy I'm up. Is that the one?
It might be. I'm not sure. Well, it's a character from English folklore, so I'm assuming it's
something. Oh, hang on. Tom Thumb is something else, isn't it? It's a folk story about a little tiny boy.
Yes, that's the one.
I wonder if there's two types of Tom Thumb then.
I haven't done my research enough, have I?
There's me thinking he was an American Civil War general, but, you know.
Well, yeah, so Tom Thumb was a character from English folklore. The book The History of Tom Thumb was published in 1621 and was the first fairy tale printed in English. The book was then already being sold in America as early as 1686. It's presumed that the author was a Londoner called Richard Johnson. So in this story, or group of stories, Tom is no bigger than his father's thumb. And his adventures include being swallowed by a cow, tangling with giants, and becoming a favourite of King Arthur. I'll just keep going while you process that. But Tom was already a traditional folk character. Johnson himself makes it clear in the book's preface that Tom was long known by old and young, bachelors and maids, and shepherd and the young ploughboy. Tom's story was originally intended for adults, but it was relegated to the nursery by the mid-19th century, and all vulgar episodes were sanitised, and moralising coloured the tale. But as well as being a character from English folklore, Tom Thumb may have been a real person. There is a grave to someone born around 1519, set into the floor in Holy Trinity Church at Tattersall in Lincolnshire, and the inscription reads, T. Thumb, aged 101, died 1620, and the grave measures just 16 inches in length. Draw your own conclusions. So, next question to the panel. Who was General Tom Thumb?
This is one of those names that I've sort of heard of, but I just think he was an American Civil War general, but you're going to prove me wrong, possibly.
The American bit is right.
Okay. So,
do you know anything?
I don't, but I remember the other kid was Jack Horner.
That's kind of a callback, but not quite.
I think he was real as well, but yeah.
So the name General Tom Thumb was given to Charles Sherwood Stratton, a circus performer who died on this day, so it's not this day, in 1883. It was a deliberate play on the English folklore Tom Thumb character because of his unusually short stature. Next question. Which American showman and circus owner gave Stratton the name General Tom Thumb?
Is it P.T. Barnum?
Yes, it is, it is. And do you know what the P and the T stand for in P.T. Barnum?
Pretty terrible person.
Any ideas? No. So it was Phineas and Taylor. Phineas Taylor Barnum. So have a guess. How much do you think Stratton weighed at birth?
How big was he as an adult?
No, I'm going to come to that. he wasn't very big. Okay. But how much do you think he weighed at birth? I'll take either pounds and ounces or kilos.
Can we do it in bags of sugar?
That's 1.1 pounds, is it?
Not sure.
No, it's a bag of sugar. 2.2. I forget now. That's how they measure very small babies, in bags of sugar, isn't
right.
it?
Okay, it's very sweet though, isn't it? So when he was born in 1838, Stratton actually weighed 9 pounds, 8 ounces. Or 4.3 kilos for the youngsters.
That's more than me.
And at 6 months, he weighed 15 pounds and was 25 inches tall. But at that point, he stopped growing. So by the age of 5, he'd not gained any weight and had only grown an extra inch. So apart from this, he was a completely normal, healthy child. He had several siblings who were all of average size. His body was proportionate and functional. It's thought that he probably had growth hormone deficiency or pituitary dwarfism. Try and say that after a couple of pints. P.T. Barnum heard about Stratton and after contacting his parents taught the boy how to sing, dance, mime and impersonate famous people. Barnum also went into business with Stratton's father who died in 1855. Stratton made his first tour of America at the age of 5 with routines that included impersonating characters such as Cupid, Hercules and Napoleon Bonaparte. As well as singing, dancing and comical banter with another performer who acted as a straight man. The tour was a huge success and soon expanded. It was then taken to Europe. So, who was the most famous person you can think of that Tom Thumb met and performed for in England?
I'm gonna guess Queen Victoria.
It was Queen Victoria and the future King Edward VII at Buckingham Palace. Stratton's fame grew at an astonishing rate and his popularity and celebrity surpassed that of any actor within his lifetime. He changed the public's perception of freak shows as they saw his shows in a favourable light. He was a talented actor, singer, dancer and comedian. So to answer your earlier question, by the age of 21 he'd reached a height of 2 feet 10 inches tall, so give you an idea of how tall he was. He got married to Lavinia Warren in 1863 at the age of 25. The wedding reception was held at New York City's Metropolitan Hotel. The couple stood atop a grand piano at the reception. How many guests do you think were there at the wedding reception?
I bet there was a huge amount. I'm going to go 500.
500?
Wow. Yeah.
I was thinking it's going to be in the thousands.
Yeah. It was actually 10,000.
Wow.
On their honeymoon trip, the couple was received by President Lincoln at the White House. In the late 1860s, the couple embarked on a 3-year world tour. Under Barnum's management, Stratton became a wealthy man. He owned a house in the fashionable part of New York and a steam yacht, and he had a wardrobe of fine clothes. Stratton died unexpectedly of a stroke in 1883 when he was 45 years old, and over 20,000 people attended the funeral. Barnum was significantly involved in politics. He mainly focused on race, slavery and sectionalism in the period preceding the American Civil War. He opposed the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which supported slavery, and left the Democratic Party because it had endorsed slavery. Barnum joined the new anti-slavery Republican Party. So there you go, that was Stratton and P.T. Barnum. So now over to you, Donna, please, for your On This Day piece. Thank you.
Hey, so I've chosen an On This Day, July the 15th from 1568. So this was a moment in history involving one of my favourite characters from history, and that is Mary, Queen of Scots. So, does anyone know what she was doing on 15th of July on 1568? It wasn't very nice. She was going to a castle. She was going to Bolton Castle. And I was like, I feel some affinity to that because that was, that's my old family name, Bolton. So, like, I feel that my people were responsible for imprisoning her. And she was one of the many places where she was imprisoned in her life. Her really, really soap opera life. So, you may not know this, but she was a cousin of Queen Elizabeth. And she was the Queen of Scotland. And we have to say Mary Queen of Scots or Mary Stuart. We can't say Queen Mary. That's other people, apparently. It's disrespectful to the English queens. But Mary Queen of Scots, she was queen from the age of 1 month. And I don't know about you, but a baby being in charge of stuff isn't great, is it? I mean, we've had all that with Boris Johnson. she was immediately seized upon as a way of sort of like getting power over Scotland. So King Henry VIII saw her and thought, I'm going to get you betrothed to my son, Prince Edward. And there was some negotiating between the families, and finally her family, the Stuarts, they said, no, thank you very much. We've got prospects in France who look a little bit more rich. And so there was actually then a war between England and Scotland, which was called the Rough Wooing. I don't like wooing to be quite rough. It doesn't sound very nice. I mean, how do you start a marriage if it starts off with a flipping great war? Anyway, it turned out not to be the case because, unfortunately, Edward died when he was very young. So Mary, Queen of Scots, she was packed off to France where she was matched with the son of Catherine of Medici, Francis. And they were matched together, so she went to go live in France. But unfortunately, even though they married, and she was only about 15 when they married, he died very young, so she returned home a young widow. And this is, I think, where it all gets very, very Hollyoaks. I don't know, if you're huge fans of history, you probably won't have seen the show Rain on TV. Has anyone heard of Rain? No. Rain is a terrible show. Has anyone heard of The Tudors? It's like that, but somehow they have less money. So they show the teen queen, Mary, as she's sort of like trying to be matched off to various suitors. And they have all the, you know, fine velvet cloaks and the lovely Elizabethan dresses. And by halfway through the series, they've quite clearly run out of money and everyone is running around in prom dresses from Sears. It is a thing to behold. But so I'm going to take you to July 15th, 1568. So Mary has been involved in power struggles all her life. And finally, Queen Elizabeth, has accused her of plotting to overthrow her. So she gets two people, so George Bowes, who is an ancestor of Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, the former Queen Mother, and Sir Francis Knollys, to take her to Bolton Castle, where Francis Knollys is going to overwatch her and sort of keep her prisoner there. And she begs to be freed, but she doesn't have any success at all. But Francis Knollys, he was a loyal supporter of Elizabeth, a bit of a staunch Protestant, and he described his castle as very strong, very fair, and very stately after the old manner of building, which I think means, in modern terms, suitable for turning into a Britannia hotel. As in, you know, not very good, needs a lot of work, probably a bit cold and damp and horrible. And of course, Mary, she did not enjoy her time there, and she really didn't enjoy her time with Sir Francis Knollys. They did not get on at all. But she did get on with Sir George Bowes, and after he had escorted her to Bolton Castle, she wrote to him and said, and thanked him for his friendship and courtesy. Even though Sir George Bowes was a loyal supporter of Elizabeth and also a staunch Protestant and a military commander and landowner in the north of England, he had a major role in suppressing the rebellion of the Northern Earls in 1569, which was led by Mary's supporters. So things were getting a little bit hot in Bolton Castle, and so Mary had to be moved. Oh, here's another bit from modern day news that might surprise you. Sir George Bowes defended Barnard Castle against the rebels. I think they were going there for an eye test. And then he later joined the Earl of Sussex in pursuing them, and he died in Chesham Castle in 1580, so quite a while afterwards. But then Mary, Queen of Scots, she had to be moved. So she got moved to Tutbury Castle. And here's where she had a bit of connection with Buxton. So she was being looked after by Bess Hardwick in particular, and her husband, Sir George Talbot, Earl of Shrewsbury. And they were very hard to try and convert Mary to Protestantism, and didn't really work. And one of the tactics that Bess Hardwick had was to sort of like sit a lot of the time with Mary, Queen of Scots, and do embroidery with her. And they did loads and loads of little bits of embroidery together. And a lot of it still exists. You can see it in various different collections. And it's supposed to be the largest collection of its kind of little, tiny, little embroideries. They did little circles, and mostly they did animals, because they really like animals. It's said to be a little bit symbolic. And here's a fact I did not know. Mary, Queen of Scots, loved monkeys. She loved monkeys. She did a lot of monkeys in these embroideries. And some people said, I know this is quite cool. When she was like sent to France for her education, she was educated alongside this chap who was called the Wild Man, who had been like found as a savage, and then he got taken to be educated with royalty. And the little monkeys were what she kind of called him. She called him an ape man. So that was probably her missing her childhood friend. I don't know how hairy he was, though. And so she stayed in Tutbury until 1585, but every now and then, Bess would treat her. They'd come up here to Buxton for a spa day. Doesn't that sound lovely? basically, she had arthritis, and the waters did her good, so they'd come here. So they didn't want her suffering, because otherwise she couldn't do the embroidery that they liked doing together so much. After 1585, she was moved to Chartley Hall in Staffordshire, and then she was moved to my home county, Northamptonshire, and she's Fotheringhay Castle, where she gave birth to James I there at the moment there, but also she got beheaded there, which isn't like, she was only 44. And so that's her association with me, my county, Northamptonshire. And people do say that Northamptonshire is the rose of the shires. Now, I'm not sure what kind of rose they mean, but I am thinking west. so anyway, that was the end of my life. But, you know, she did have that association with Buxton. She used to come here for her waters. She liked embroidering monkeys and cats, also cats. So I think she was very similar to me in that she did like cats. So that was Mary, Queen of Scots.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you. Can I just ask one thing? So Bolton Castle, I take it, isn't actually in Bolton.
No.
Where is it?
Where is it? It's Leeds, isn't it?
No? Oh, is it Leeds?
Yorkshire. Yeah.
Thank you. Right, I'm going to do a second on this day segue piece. So, questions to the panel. What social media prototype was first made publicly available on this day in 2006?
2006.
Social media prototype?
Hmm.
Ooh. I know Twitter came out that year.
Yay! Yeah. That's the answer. Twitter, yes. Yes, remarkably, Twitter has not been around for as many as two decades yet. Twitter's origins lie in a day-long brainstorming session held by board members of the podcasting company Odeo. Jack Dorsey, then an undergraduate student at New York University, introduced the idea of an individual using an SMS service to communicate with a small group. The service was originally called Twitter. It didn't have any vowels in it, basically. So. Twitter. Because the domain name twitter.com was already in use, but then they managed to purchase it. So thank goodness for that. Work on the project started on 21st of March 2006 when Dorsey published the first Twitter message. What do you think that first message was?
It's going to be testing. Is this working?
Hello, Mum.
It was just setting up my Twitter. Dorsey thought the name Twitter was a perfect name for the service, given its definition of a short burst of inconsequential information and chirps from birds. By the end of 2012, Twitter announced it had surpassed 200 million monthly active users. A bit of kind of recent history. In May 2020, Twitter moderators marked two tweets from US President Donald Trump as potentially misleading and linked it to a fact check. Trump responded by signing an executive order to weaken Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which limits social media sites' liability for content moderation decisions. Twitter later banned Trump, claiming that he violated the glorification of violence policy. The ban was criticised by conservatives and some European leaders who saw it as an interference on freedom of speech. Question: what happened after the platform removed tweets made by the Nigerian president, Muhammadu Buhari, in 2021?
I'm guessing he didn't then set up his own social media platform.
He may well have done, actually. It's not in my notes, but...
I have no idea.
No, that's fine. On June 5th, 2021, the Nigerian government issued an indefinite ban on Twitter usage in the country. Citing misinformation and fake news spread through it have had real-world violent consequences. You probably know this. How much did Elon Musk pay for Twitter in 2022?
Oh, is it 44 million?
$44 billion.
I like how you just went up there,
A thousand
guineas.
Just out of interest, do you use Twitter? Do you have any experience of it?
Yes, and unfortunately, because I had to get in touch with somebody who left Twitter and had no other way of communicating with him, I had to join Threads recently. Mm. I wish I'd just been the lot of it. I really do.
Yeah, I was on for a while, but then I realised it's just an absolute cesspool of humanity, so ditched that.
I do like to learn.
Keep my accounts open, though, you know.
Yeah.
Got to push the show.
Apart from Richard Pulsford on Twitter, and it just so happened on Twitter, that's not a cesspool. So. How many daily active users are there, do you think? So people use it every day.
Oh, gosh, I bet there's more people actively using it than exist in the world because of all the bots.
So more than 7 billion, then, you're saying?
Probably not, actually. Probably about, is it 3 billion a day?
Yeah. Any ideas?
Oh, is it 200 million active users?
Wow, that is so close. 229 million daily active users as of late 2022. So it's actually not as widely used as maybe you'd think. What percentage of users are between the ages of 25 and 49? Just picking a random kind of middle category.
At least half.
Yeah, it's 59%. And just out of interest, what do you think is the split of male to female users? Do you think there's any... Is it 50-50 or is it different to that?
I would say 60-40 to the guys.
To the guys?
Yeah.
I think that's probably about right.
Interestingly, it's 71% male and 29% female users.
Yes. You can kind of tell.
I get this feeling, not the people here use Twitter, I get the feeling, so I don't know. So now comes the second half of the show, I guess, why a lot of people are here, because we uncover now some of the history of Buxton. So I've just got some random stuff to start off with. So Buxton is a spa town in Derbyshire, for our listeners' sake, with a population of about 22,000, and was named by the Sunday Times 5 years ago as one of the top 50 towns and suburbs to live in Britain. Yes. After periods of heavy rain... need to use your imagination there. The river flowing through the town often turns a striking orange colour. It must be incredibly orange this weekend. No, I didn't say that. Yes, right. It happens when the river level rises and flows through iron-bearing strata from the remains of coal mining workings in Burbage. Question for the panel. What is odd about Water Street near the Opera House?
Ooh. Was there a scandal there at one time in a hotel?
Ooh.
The thing that I find odd about it is that I still expect there to be public toilets there.
Yes. So it's a street with no buildings, but it did once have a public toilet. Yes. Incidentally, Bennett Street is so called because it was laid out on land belonging to the local physician, Dr. Robert Otiwell Gifford Bennett. The sign at the top of the road used to be misspelt with two T's, while the one at the bottom of the road was spelt correctly with only one T in Bennett. However, the signs were recently changed and the disparity was rectified. Both now successfully misspelled the name of two T's.
Do you not have many editors in Buxton? Is that it?
Some of my work for the council, sometimes. Question to the panel. Why was the street Dale Side known as the Pies?
Did somebody eat it? All of it?
That's stuck in the thumb.
Yes. I don't know if anyone's going to keep correcting me if I say things wrong here, but there used to be a bakery at the top end of the road. Oh, we're getting nonsense. So that's, you used to live there? Or did you get the smell from the bakery? Or?
No, it was after the bakery.
It was after the bakery.
It was a garage when I was there.
Oh, right, lots of good, lots of good. Who were the Buxton bath chairmen?
Ooh, so a bath chair is like a kind of wheelchair, normally. So they would be like a kind of like peacock design wicker, and then you'd trundle along on little wheels. So I imagine the bath chairmen would be invalids who probably come to experience the waters here. Would that be right?
Suspect it might be the other way around.
Oh, the people who push them.
Buxton's one of those weird towns that is split, that we've got Lower Buxton and Higher Buxton here, and a very steep hill between them, and I think that they were hand-pushed taxi men.
Yeah, yeah. So during the 19th century, wealthy visitors to Buxton would hire bath chairs, a kind of chaise longue on wheels with a folding hood. You need that. To take them from their lodgings to the spa buildings. Bath chairmen would push them from behind while the passengers steered. Sounds like quite fun, really.
Bring them back. That's what I say. I don't know. I am not as thin or as fit as I used to be, and these hills have killed me so far.
True or false, have the Beatles played Buxton?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Let me just think about that. Let me... Do we get points for this? Yes.
Yeah, they played here not once, but twice. In 1963, they performed in the Pavilion Gardens Ballroom on the 6th of April and 19th of October 1963. Someone's going to say they were there, are they? No, okay. I just had that feeling.
Too young.
Of course. Have you heard of any of the following celebrities from Buxton as listed on Wikipedia, and what are they known for? Okay, so number one, Lloyd Cole.
Yes! Lloyd Cole and the Commitments, a very fine singer-songwriter.
Commotions!
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, that's a lost weekend.
When asked about returning to his hometown, he replied, "We have been back. My wife couldn't deal with the weather." Although she's starting to get used to wearing a sweater in July.
I can remember Lloyd Cole when I think it was his second or third album, where he's kind of like, he had a bit of a fringe and he had like a cross on it. And there was a programme, I think Network 7, and there was this reverend who was a vampire hunter, and he said, "I've got proof, I've got a photograph of a vampire." And he had like this grainy black and white photo that I immediately recognised as the front cover of his album. So apparently Lloyd Cole is a vampire, but he's already been staked, so.
Good, excellent. So, second celebrity, Tim Brooke Taylor.
Mm. Yes.
Who is he then?
Goodies.
Absolutely. Yeah. Comedian, not a solicitor.
He managed to get expelled from primary school at the age of 5.5 years. Impressive. Right, number three, who was Vera Brittain?
Oh, there you go. Yeah, the famed sort of war biographer, anti-war protester. Yeah, just one of the famous daughters of the town.
And also mother of politician Shirley Williams. Mm. She seems to have hated Buxton.
There's a theme here, Richard. I'm not sure how this is going down.
Number four, who was Elizabeth Spriggs?
Oh, sounds familiar, but I'm not sure.
Okay, so she was an actor, born in Buxton and had an unhappy childhood.
Yeah, but what was she in? What was she in? Do we know it? Do we know anything she was in? That's how I know people, just they're actors.
I just took some information off Wikipedia. I don't know.
Paul Tracy. Who's
in Harry Potter?
Yeah,
Harry Potter.
Paul Tracy in the first film.
Right, thank you. Right.
First, just find the Potter first. Yeah.
Excellent. Right, number five. Dave Lee Travis.
Yes. Bearded cornflake. Yes. Something like that. Apart from that, I will mention no more of his name.
Yes, disc jockey, one charge of indecent assault by a majority verdict. So. And finally, Bruno Langley.
Mm-hmm. Went to school with him.
I did. Ex-coronation.
Yeah, I looked up the news story.
Yes, ex-Coronation Street star, guilty of sexual assault. So there you go, Buxton celebrity.
I hope there's nothing in the water.
Swiftly moving on. So, John Cain. He was born in Ireland in 1746, was a famous actor and comedian who travelled England performing in the late 18th century. The playbill for the Buxton Theatre from 25th of August 1792 shows that he was playing the old Cockney character in a farce called Romp. And he was performing again in Buxton in 1799. Some say it was at the Buxton Opera House, but that wasn't built for another 100 years. Others reckon it was at the Wheatsheaf. Anyway, according to popular folklore, Cain had a large appetite and particularly enjoyed roast beef with horseradish sauce. While he was dining out in Buxton, someone prepared this dish for him. Except that instead of using wild horseradish, they had gathered and cooked aconitum, or conium maculatum, i.e. hemlock. What effect did this have on Cain?
Oh my gosh, that doesn't sound like a very healthy thing to eat. Yeah, it's poisonous, and it's like, yeah, pretty much instant death, isn't it?
He died.
Yeah.
He died, yes. Thank you, Buxton. Have you dined out at all in Buxton?
No. You recommend anyone that doesn't have hemlock?
Yeah, I'd avoid the roast beef and horseradish. Incidentally, hemlock is from the same family of flowering plants as carrot, celery, coriander, fennel, parsley and parsnip. Remember, earlier this year, the supermarket which left daffodils out on display next to the spring onions. So it's a mistake to make these things. John Cain's grave is located at the rear of St Anne's Churchyard in Buxton and is a listed monument due to his fame, and also because he was said to have eaten himself to death.
Now, it wasn't really his fault, though, was it?
Well, I think, yeah, leading up to that. Anyway, I've not checked this out, but apparently online, what's unusual about his grave?
Oh, I don't know. The answer's over there, I think.
Do you know?
But what if you guess what could be unusual? Is there like a weird headstone? No, you don't.
There's no headstone. Or he's buried vertically.
Well, you get more along those lines. So his grave is turned to face all the other graves, so that he was laid to rest in the same way he'd lived his life, facing an audience.
Oh, God.
We know what dying on stage is like. Right, let's talk about Harper Hill as the next topic. So we've already established that Buxton lays claim to being the market town with the highest elevation in the country and possibly the highest rainfall to go with it. So, question, where in the area is the highest bowling green in England? That's really more for you. But
well, I'm guessing it would be in Harper Hill.
Yes. So this is I gave that away, didn't I? It's a small village on the outskirts of Buxton. There used to be limestone quarry works there, and the bowling green was made for the local quarry workers. Well, that was before they decided to build houses on it. Limestone was extracted there at least as far back as the 1600s, but on an industrial scale between 1835 and 1952. Lime kilns on site would burn the calcium carbonate, or lime, to produce calcium oxide, or quicklime. Question. Why did the RAF dig tunnels in Harper Hill in 1938?
That was as an ammunition storage, I believe.
Yeah, to store chemical weapons, specifically. The site covered 500 acres and was the largest such depot in the UK. After World War II, the site was used as an X-station to dispose of unexploded ordnance, i.e. German chemical munitions and V-rocket warheads. They were disposed of by burning with bleach on site, but that produced huge quantities of smoke and in the end was left incomplete. Some mustard gas, good timing. Some mustard gas escaped as a vapour and much of the nearby vegetation was killed. The RAF depot was closed in 1960. So after the RAF left, what did they do with the munitions tunnels? What were they used for? Did you hear that?
No, not at all. So you're very good at whispering.
What might you use dark tunnels for?
Could it be growing mushrooms?
Yes, growing mushrooms. And then as a cold store for cheese. A warehouse was also built to store dry and bonded wines and spirits. So I bet Harper Hill has held some amazing cheese and wine glasses. What is the local so-called Blue Lagoon?
Well, it's one of the most Instagrammable locations, especially during COVID lockdown.
Yeah, do you want to say more?
I believe it's sort of I guess you'd call it a lake, but an abandoned, apart from the abandoned quarry works, incredibly alkaline, but a beautiful turquoise colour.
Yeah. So the colour was due to calcium carbonate particles in the water, which makes it look inviting to swim in. So this is in the old quarry workings up Far Hill. But yeah, as you've alluded to, yeah, why should you not swim in it?
That sounds quite acidic.
Alkaline. The one. So it has an alkaline pH level of 11.3, so compare that to bleach, which has a pH level of 12.3. So it's not surprising to learn that the water causes skin and eye irritations and stomach problems. This has been caused by the byproducts from the lime burning, and that's before you consider how cold the water is, and the garbage, human waste and old mine machinery left on site. In spite of all this, it remains a popular spot to visit.
Oh, my life. Yeah, I should apologise. I did get an A in chemistry, but it was a long time ago.
So what did High Peak Borough Council do to try to deter visitors to the Blue Lagoon?
Did they put a monster in it?
I think it needs one.
I think it's already in there, yeah. You probably need to stop it being blue.
Yeah. They put Dave Lee Travis on guard.
They tried to dye the water black, so to put people off. They didn't look so inviting.
All the gods came.
So they did that three times in 2013, 2016, and in 2020. Didn't really work that well. So how did local farmers then try to deter visitors to the area in June 2020?
Get off my land.
It is private land. They spread pig and cow slurry across the surrounding land. And still people go.
It's like you can't smell it on Instagram, can you? That's the thing.
Yeah. Ironically, Harper Hill is also home to HSL, the Health and Safety Executives Health and Safety Laboratory. It has a staff of over 350 scientists who investigate serious accidents. Apparently, they have their own underground train.
Oh,
well, that sounds like fun, doesn't it?
In those old tunnels.
Yeah.
Wow. Open them up with the bath chairs. Bring them back to Boston.
Incidentally, as well as having the highest elevation of any bowling green in England, Buxton Football Club is the highest football ground above sea level in England. And Buxton Rugby Union Club is said to have the highest rugby club goalposts in the country.
They're really tall as well.
So, on the subject of sport, which national sports championships allegedly started in Buxton?
Ooh, is this football? No.
It's very apposite for this weekend.
Oh, so that would be tennis then?
Yes. Ah. Yes.
I was thinking Morris dancing. There's been so much of it. But I suppose they got the sticks.
I did my comedy show earlier and I said something nasty about Morris dancers and everyone booed me. It was the only place in the country where that could happen. Anyway. It was in Leamington Spa that a new game called Svarestrike was played in 1873. This later became known as lawn tennis and then simply tennis. Svarestrike derives from an ancient Greek word meaning playing the ball with skill.
Also, it sounds like Svarestrike, which
is
hitting a ball.
Oh, have I said it wrong?
No.
I said it wrong?
No, I don't think you have, but it sounds like that.
Maybe it's the same, I don't know. By 1880, Buxton had established a tournament for visiting players of this popular new sport in Buxton Gardens, just as one was also established in Wimbledon. It was held in early August here. The high-quality croquet lawns sited on land now used by the miniature railway were taken over and marked out into five fine grass courts on which the most important matches were played, with a further two just further away. The tournament in Buxton had both women and men competitors right from the start, with gentlemen's doubles, mixed doubles, and handicap events introduced as time went on. There were so many entries to the tournament that in 1884, the proprietors of the gardens, the Buxton Improvements Company, are they still going? decided to run an open tournament with ladies and gentlemen singles played under the title of Championship of Derbyshire, and a ladies' doubles played under the title of All England Ladies' Doubles. The All England Championship was the first of its kind, so Buxton used the title for its tournament right up until 1951, when the tournament here ceased. The 1912 Buxton tournament winners had prizes which were presented by no less a figure than Field Marshal Frederick Slay Roberts, 1st Earl Roberts, VC, KG, KP, GCB, OM, GCSI, GCIE, VD, PC, FRSGS, one of the most successful British military commanders of his time. He died in 1914 and lay in state in Westminster Hall. One of only two people who, not members of the royal family, to have lain in Westminster Hall during the 20th century. Who was the other?
Oh, that's got to be Churchill.
It was Churchill, yeah. So you had your celebrities here in Buxton giving out the tennis prizes. I will do a final piece, but at this point, can we thank the Buxton Fringe and the Green Man Gallery for hosting us. Thank you. And please give it up for today's guests you saw and heard, Scott Alsop and Donna Scott. So do remember History Pod, and remember Donna's got a show at 9 o'clock as well. Our next shows for the It Just So Happened podcast will be at the Hill Street Theatre in Edinburgh every day from Friday 4th of August to the Sunday 12th of August at 10:30 a.m. as part of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. So a final On This Day piece in which to end the show. Playwright and short story writer Anton Chekhov died on this day in 1904 in Badensweiler, Germany. Chekhov is considered to be one of the greatest writers of all time. So here are five sayings from his writing to end the show. The first one. Let us learn to appreciate there will be times when the trees will be bare, and look forward to the time when we may pick the fruit. Number two, the more refined one is, the more unhappy. Number three, how unbearable at times are people who are happy, people for whom everything works out. Number four, all of life and human relations have become so incomprehensibly complex that when you think about it, it becomes terrifying and your heart stands still. That was then.
Before Twitter.
Before Twitter. And the final one to end the show. Medicine is my lawful wife and literature my mistress. And when I get tired of one, I spend the night with the other. And with that, thank you for coming and goodbye.